We've been hanging out in the Gospel of John for a few Sundays now. Before that, during Lent, we looked at a series of parables, also from the Gospels. Today, something different. We're going to turn to the book of Acts. If the Gospels are understood as telling the story of Jesus, Acts is sort of like telling the story of the Holy Spirit and what happened after Jesus was no longer walking among his followers. Acts is about how the early church was built, and it tells about the main players who were responsible for building it. Of course, no one did more to build the church than Paul, and today we're going to hear a story about him. So please grab a pew Bible and turn in it to Acts chapter 17. Acts comes right after the Gospel of John, so whoever finds Acts chapter 17 first gets $100. No, I'm just kidding. Not really. Whoever finds it first gets to shout out the page number. Acts 17. Say it again. 137. It is. I'm hoping that everyone's able to see a Bible because I'm going to quickly go through the chapter and I won't be reading the whole thing, just referring here and there, and it will help you to follow what I'm saying if you can look at the text. So thank you for turning to it. Chapter 17 begins with Paul and Silas. His sidekick, Silas. They are traveling all over Thessalonica, north of Greece, trying to establish Jesus as the Messiah, build up the early church. Acts tells us that some people they talked to were persuaded and joined them, including, as it says in verse 4 there, not a few of the leading women. One of the references to the role of women in the early church that we see. So some folks are receptive, other people aren't. Tension is building within Judaism. Paul and Silas, of course, are Jews who follow the way, as they were known. And traditional Jews resisted that understanding of Jesus as Messiah. So we're at the point in which Christianity is emerging from Judaism. Beginning in verse 5, we hear about attacks on a man named Jason. Jason supported Paul, and he was attacked for that. Things are getting dicey and dangerous, and so Paul and Silas decide it's a good idea to get the heck out of Dodge. They do. They head down the road to a place called Berea. They're pursued by those who want to do them harm, want to shut them up. Well, as soon as they get to Berea, Paul heads straight to the synagogue, and he starts arguing. Arguing is like Paul's favorite pastime. Verse 11 says that the Jews in Berea were more receptive than the ones in Thessalonica had been. Verse 12 again says that not a few Greek women and rich men joined them. Paul and Silas are gaining momentum when in verse 13 that Thessalonica group shows up that had been hotly pursuing Paul. And so Paul gets the heck out of Dodge again, this time he goes to the coast. Specifically, he goes to Athens, Greece. Paul was always on the run, just one step ahead of people who didn't like what he had to say. And the Bible, by the way, doesn't say how Paul ultimately dies, but we have some other sources outside of the Bible that indicate that Paul was eventually martyred. But we pick up our reading while he's going strong. Hey, is that Vanessa Adia, candidate for District 12? Okay, good. Thank you for reading today, Vanessa. We'll start reading in verse 16.
While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was deeply distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he argued in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and also in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Also, some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers debated with him.
Now, the part that she said, the very first verse, verse 16, we'll come back to it, but I just wanted you to note it for now, that he was deeply distressed to see that the city of Athens was full of idols. We'll get back to that. So, that's Paul hanging out. He's arguing with anybody who happens to be there. And I'm making light of it. Of course, arguing was a form of expressing his position and engaging dialogue about it. Didn't matter if it was in the synagogue or the market, according to this verse, or even with philosophers sitting around in white robes in some place with marble columns. Okay, I don't know if it's like that, but I picture it that way. Boom, Paul is in their face arguing. Verse 18.
Also, some Epicurean and Stoic philosophers debated with him. Some said, "What does this babbler want to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a proclaimer of foreign divinities." This was because he was telling the good news about Jesus and the resurrection.
So, opinion is sharply divided in his audience on whether Paul is a babbler or a genius. Paul thought that he was communicating good news. That's what it was to Paul. But to other Jews, this idea that Jesus was God was not welcomed. Jesus, when he was alive, didn't appear to talk about himself in that way. That understanding came later as Christianity continued to differentiate itself from Judaism. At this point, though, the way Paul is talking about Jesus as if he is divine seems to compromise the monotheistic nature of Judaism. Jews believed that there was one God with no other gods beside God. So these folks don't quite get what Paul is talking about. It sounds like he's saying there are two gods. So what do the people in Athens do? Well, it's actually awesome what they do. Unlike in Thessalonica, where they drug Paul's folks out and beat them up, these Athenians do something eminently reasonable. Verse 19.
So they took him, and they brought him to the Areopagus and asked him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? It sounds rather strange to us, so we would like to know what it means." Now, all the Athenians and the foreigners living there would spend their time in nothing but telling or hearing something new.
So people in Athens just love to learn something new. How cool is that? They're curious. Instead of condemning Paul, they want to learn more. So they invite him to speak so they can better understand his position. They're intellectually curious rather than automatically hostile. Something we need a little more of, I think, today. Verse 22.
Then Paul stood in front of the Areopagus.
So picture like an open-air site up on the hill next to the Acropolis, the rough equivalent of city council where they would hear public debates. Verse 22.
Then Paul stood in front of the Areopagus and said, "Athenians, I see how extremely religious you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at your objects of worship..."
Okay, Paul is being a consummate politician here. Remember, what did it say back in verse 16? It actually said there that Paul had looked around the city and he was very distressed to see all the idols. But he's not leading with that here. Instead, he's buttering them up, right? I mean, really, he is establishing himself as a scholar, since earlier in the chapter he had been dismissed by some as a babbler. He wants to come across as a skilled orator. So he starts with a surefire approach, a compliment that will create goodwill between him and his audience. Back again to verse 22.
Then Paul stood in front of the Areopagus and said, "Athenians, I see how extremely religious you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at your objects of your worship, I found among them an altar with the inscription, 'To an unknown God.'"
Now, Athenians, as we've learned, were tolerant and inclusive in their worship. Not only did they have altars to all of the different gods they could think of, they even had an altar to an unknown god, so that they wouldn't give offense to any that they may have overlooked. Pick up the middle of verse 23.
"What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, God who is Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in shrines made by human hands, nor is God served by human hands, as though God needed anything, since God gives to all mortals life and breath and all things."
The Creator God, as Paul understands God, is Lord of all and everywhere. I mean, Jews had earlier conceived of God as limited somewhat to a particular place, specifically the temple. Paul says that God doesn't need anything from humans, including a shrine to live in. God is a gracious benefactor who creates and gives to mortals life and breath, everything that is. Verse 26.
From one ancestor, God made all nations to inhabit the whole earth. And God allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the place where they would live, so that they would search for God and perhaps grope for God and find God. Though indeed, God is not far from each one of us.
Here Paul is attempting to include the Athenians as part of one family of God. Even though they seem to be separate from each other, Paul is saying everything derives from God. Everyone is a part of one family, so that makes us kin. Verse 28.
For in God we live and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we too are God's offspring.
Those two phrases and quotes, he's drawing from Greek poetry to back up his point, something that would be familiar to his audience. Both quotes here, in God we live and move and have our being, and for we too are God's offspring, likely come from Stoic philosophers. So by using their own sources, Paul is hoping that his audience will agree that all human existence comes from God and depends upon God. And the last verse that we're going to read today, verse 29.
Since we are all God's offspring, we ought not to think that the deity is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of mortals.
Thank you, Vanessa. According to Paul, then, God must be worshipped in accordance with who God is, and human religious practice must reflect humanity's kinship with God. Progressive Christians believe that the Bible and its stories are a gift to us from our ancestors in the faith, human beings who wrote in a variety of cultures and contexts. Their writings are collected in the Bible. We understand the Bible, then, not as God's words, but as the words of our ancestors. It includes their best observations about God, what they thought God wanted of them. The Bible, then, is their insight, and it also contains their bias and limitation, and we have to determine which is which. We have to parse that out. So I'm going to close with a few observations from this passage to get the conversation started. As always, I love hearing from you during the week, what your observations are. First of all, I don't know about you, but I think the Athenians were pretty great. I mean, Athens was a place of considerable intellect and cultural prominence and importance. They were people who, when challenged, sought to learn more rather than go on the attack. They considered it important first to listen. I think we should all be listeners. Now, Paul clashed a bit with that open-mindedness because he was so singularly focused on building the church. It has been said, and accurately so, I think, that Jesus didn't start Christianity. Paul did, that Jesus saw himself as a reformer of Judaism. And I'm glad that Paul was successful in establishing Christianity, because we now have inherited this vast and rich tradition of Christianity, a diverse tradition. Most people don't realize that, but it's very diverse. It's a wonderful place that we can take root and grow. Of course, there exists today a number of insightful religious foundations in which a person could put down roots and grow strong. Christianity is one among them. Now, I'm not big on hardline efforts to coerce or convert people. So, as I read this story, I don't really care for Paul's approach when he's talking about the altar of the unknown God. It sounds sort of patronizing to me when he tells them, "Let me tell you what you're really doing when you worship like that." It sticks in my craw a bit because no one person can tell another who or what God is. We can share our experiences, and I hope that we do, because we learn and grow from each other. But no one has God figured out for another, period. That is the sacred opportunity that's given to each individual. And diverse understandings of God are valued. They're important as all of us seek to understand sacred mystery. I prefer a world where we all live our lives as an example of what empowered spiritual understanding looks like, according to each one of us. So there are some things that Paul says there that don't resonate with me, but there's a lot that Paul says here about God that does. I mean, I don't believe for a minute that humanity is descended from two people, Adam and Eve. Not in any literal way do I understand that to be true. But I do believe that all of humanity is one. And common ancestors of Adam and Eve, well, that's a metaphorical way to express the truth that across time, across context, across belief, we are all one. Something cannot be good for me unless it is also good for you. We are one, and if we can ever manage to act like it, the world would be a better place. And like Paul says, we grope for God. I love that expression. We grope for God, for the holy, and sometimes we have those fleeting experiences of touching just a little bit of the divine. And through it all, God is nearer than we know. God is never far from us. We live and move and have our being immersed in holiness all the time. I believe that. God is not formed, as Paul says, from the imagination of mortals. In any language or thought or belief we come up with will be limiting and probably inaccurate. God is not made of gold or silver. There is one primary way that God is made known, and that is in us. We are God's offspring, as Paul says. Ultimately, God is mystery, and perhaps even unknowable. So if we can't know God fully, if our words are inadequate, then why use them? Should we just stop trying? I hope the poets never stop trying to talk about a deeper realm. I hope that poets keep at it, and musicians, and artists, and theologians, and orators, and mystics. I hope they all keep hammering away at it, believers and non-believers alike. We all add just a little bit to that evolving story of all that is, the evolving story that some of us call God. I, for one, am grateful to every single contribution. So I'd like to close with the observation of poet Mary Oliver. I included, it's on the flip side of the next page of your bulletin. I'm going to read an excerpt from one of her poems called At the River Clarion. Just a note, I wish she had used inclusive language for God. She didn't, but I'm going to read it as she wrote it. I don't know who God is exactly, but I'll tell you this. I was sitting in the river named Clarion on a water-splashed stone, and all afternoon I listened to the voices of the river talking. Whenever the water struck a stone, it had something to say, and the water itself, and even the mosses trailing under the water. And slowly, very slowly, it became clear to me what they were saying. Said the river, I am part of holiness. And I too, said the stone, and I too, whispered the moss beneath the water. If God exists, he isn't just churches and mathematics. He's the forest. He's the desert. He's the ice caps that are dying. He's the ghetto and the Museum of Fine Arts. He's Van Gogh and Allen Ginsberg and Robert Motherwell. He's the many desperate hands cleaning and preparing their weapons. He's every one of us, potentially. The leaf of grass, the genius, the politician, the poet, And if this is true, isn't it something very important?